Across a movie, perhaps some of you might know it. It's called The Princess Bride. Anyone seen it? While I was watching, I picked it up right in the middle of the movie, this bride, and their boat has just come into this little harbor where are these giant cliffs, right? And there's these kidnappers who are kidnapping the princess, and they're already climbing up the rope, and there's this guy wearing all black, and he's climbing up the rope behind them because he's trying to come and rescue the girl. And so they're getting up to the top, the kidnappers, and they get there, and the leader of the group, a guy by the name of Vizzini, looks down and he's like, how can he climb this? It's inconceivable, right? He says it over and over again for us. But as he says this, he says, well, here's the easy way to solve this problem. Let's cut the rope. So he cuts the rope. Sure enough, Wesley, our hero, catches hold of the rock, and he's still able to climb. And he looks down, and he's like, how did he make it? It's inconceivable. He's like, well, this isn't my problem. So he sends his friend, the swordsman, Inigo Montoya, and he says, stay here, and when he gets up here, kill him. And so as the movie progresses, Wesley's climbing up the rocks, and our Inigo Montoya, our Spaniard, is growing more and more impatient because he just wants to take care of Wesley. And he keeps looking down. He's like, are you going to finish? Are you going to come up? Are you going to come up? And he's like, you're just up there to kill me, right? And he's like, well, yeah. And he's like, well, I think you're just going to have to wait then. And he's like, how about if I throw you the rope? And he's like, that sort of speeds up the process, doesn't it? And he's like, yeah. And he's like, sorry, I'm still going to wait. He's like, here's the thing. I give you my word as a Spaniard that you will make it to the top alive. And of course, Wesley's response is, I've known too many Spaniards. So then, his voice goes all dramatic, and he's like, okay, I swear on the soul of my father, Domingo Montoya, that you will reach the top alive. Wesley's response, throw me the rope. What happened? What flipped? Right, it's this idea that, as Inigo says, I promise upon something far grander, far more important than myself, that you will make it alive, that Wesley says, oh, now I'll believe you. As if that somehow overdoes his Spaniardness, right? Well, we do the same thing. You know, as kids, you go around, when you really want someone to believe you, what do you say? Cross my heart, hope to die, stick a needle in my eye. If I say that, there's no way in the world that I'm lying. As adults, we do this too. We say, I swear on my life. This is more in movies. I don't think we say this as often anymore, but like, I swear on the grave or the soul of my parents, just like Inigo, we say something similar. Oftentimes, we're asked to swear on the Bible, right? You go into a courtroom, and you're told to put your hand in the Bible and swear that you'll tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. When any time we do that, the goal is really always the same. We're trying to persuade somebody that we're not lying. Or we're binding ourselves to tell the truth. Wouldn't it be just, you know, better to just answer simply to be like, yeah, I'm not going to do that. It'd be really great. I don't have to swear. I don't have to say anything. It's just like, yeah, I'm not lying. But the problem is, of course, that much like Wesley knew too many Spaniards, we all know too many humans. And it's just not how this works. We'd like to trust people at their word, but it's often counterproductive. And even more than that, we find out that we're betrayed over and over and over again. Well, the beauty of the scriptures is that the problems of today are often the problems of yesterday. And our text in James addresses a similar concern as we look at our text this morning. And as we dive into chapter 5, verse 12, we'll spend time looking really at three things. First, the context of James's statement about swearing oaths. Where's he coming from? And then we're going to contrast oaths against vows, because the Bible has a lot to say about vows. And finally, what I want us to really kind of walk away with is that the good news in all of this is that because God is faithful to his word, that it leads us to be faithful to ours. So as we look at James 5:12, really, it seems like a simple statement, right? You know, we already read it, so I can paraphrase it now. Don't swear. Just say yes or no. And if you don't, you'll be condemned. Really simple. I suppose I could just say, do that. We could go ahead and take communion, although Paul's not ready. But I think that I'm paid to do a little more than that. So let's look a little bit more deeply into what James is really, really getting at, because I think a little bit more is going on. First, I want us to note that this verse is really about how we use our tongue. And the reason I want to point that out is because that is one of the primary themes that we see all through James. In this case, it's the question of do we swear, do we speak, do we swear by heaven? Do we swear by earth? Are we allowed to swear any oaths at all? Is this something we're allowed to do? Here's just a few notables throughout James so that we can kind of be reminded of all of the things that he said. If you just flipped back to chapter 4, here's a couple things. I won't read the verses, but I'll highlight the points. We don't have what we desire because we don't ask for the right things, or we don't ask in faith. He says, don't slander one another. Don't boast about what you plan to do. If you flip back to James chapter 3, verses 1 through 12, the whole theme of that is about how your tongue can cause good and cause harm, and how we use our tongue matters. If we go back to James 1, he says we should be quick to listen and slow to speak, how we use our tongue. He says that those who are religious ought to keep a tight rein on their tongues. And in the following verses, what's going to come in the next couple weeks as we wrap up James, it's also how we use our tongue to pray. What we say and how we speak is extremely important to James. And one of the ways for us to properly use our tongue in this particular situation is to speak honestly. Let your yes be yes. Let your no be no. The second thing I want us to think about is that James begins with the words above all. Now, oftentimes when we hear the words above all, we think, man, this must be his most important point. I'm not exactly sure that's how he's using it. As if you look at what's going on in all of chapter 5, he hits on a couple different things. It's almost like a list of things as he wraps up the letter that he wants for us to be aware of that are really important to him. Things like oppression from the rich, patience in suffering, and how to pray on behalf of others. And in this situation, it doesn't seem like verse 12 sort of fits into any of those. In fact, I was having a conversation with some friends of mine this past week where we were talking about James and how, for the most part, the book sort of everything hangs together and you're like, this means this and this means this, and you can tie it together. But somehow verse 12 just seems to like hang out there on its own. And even commentators are like, yeah, we're not sure where 5:12 comes in. It's almost like James is like, oh yeah, don't forget. I got to get this one in. And so the above all probably is a transition of, I think I'm getting to the end of the letter. I think I'm kind of getting to the end of what I want to say. And so above all else, before I forget, let me get this in. Don't swear oaths. This is where he's going. He believes this is important, and he wants to make sure that we hear it before he wraps up his letter, and it fits with all of his themes. Well, the last part, though, of the context, and I think this is the part where I want to dwell on for a few minutes, is how we examine James's use of Jesus. Because really, this passage, this verse itself, is a paraphrase of what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, back in Matthew chapter 5, verses 33 to 37. And here's what he says. Again, you have heard it said to the people long ago, do not break your oath, but fulfill to the Lord the vows you have made. But I tell you, do not swear an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is God's throne, or by earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make even one hair white or black. All you need to say is simply yes or no. Anything beyond this comes from the evil one. Sounds like James has heard this saying before, right? There's a lot of similarities, kind of cuts it down to size a little bit, but a lot of similarities. On the surface, one might think that Jesus is just saying, All oaths are bad, don't make them. But there's a deeper issue that Jesus is addressing in the Sermon on the Mount, and I think it's important we understand it before we just kind of throw anything out about vows and oaths. First, he begins by saying, again, you have heard it said. This is how Jesus teaches in the Sermon on the Mount to the people long ago. He was referencing this teaching that existed amongst Jewish leaders. There was a significant debate that went on amongst Jewish leaders as to how one had to fulfill oaths. And they came up with this huge hierarchy of how one could, like, have to fulfill an oath, maybe have to fulfill an oath, maybe have a loophole in my oath, depending on how I swore my oath. Here are a couple examples. If one swore on the Lord, I swear to God, they were required to fulfill their vow, right? Because if they were doing that, they would be breaking a promise that they made to God. But if they were to swear by heaven or by earth, then they wouldn't have to be able to fulfill the vow because, well, I didn't swear to God and some things came up and, you know, like, I can't do this thing. They would find a way to worm out of the oath because I didn't swear by God, so I don't have to do it. Because what the Bible tells us to do is it's only if we swear to God that we have to fulfill our oaths. The same would be true if they swore by their head. I swear on my head, I swear on myself, right? That I will do the thing that I said. There's ways out. They could say, I swear by Jerusalem, our city. Be like swearing by, you know, DC. Maybe most of us wouldn't want to do that anymore. But swearing by DC, that I'm gonna do the thing that is most important. I promise I'll do this. And yet, they could swear by Jerusalem and break the oath. But if they swore toward Jerusalem, where God's temple was, they couldn't break the oath. You see how it goes? This is pretty confusing, isn't it? Got all this layering and ins and outs. And you see, some of the Pharisees actually use this language in the Gospels. If you're reading through Matthew, there's a couple times that Jesus engages with the Pharisees over kind of how they do this. And what Jesus is trying to do is to reframe this whole discussion. In fact, as he engages these loopholes, he says, listen, if you swear by heaven, what is heaven? He's like, it's God's throne room. So if you swear by heaven, you're swearing by God. If you swear by the earth, what is the earth? The earth is God's footstool. God's there too. So if you swear by the earth, you're also swearing to God. He's like, and even if you swear by your own head, guess what? You can't control your own head. You know who controls whether your hair is gray or black or white or anything in between? It's God. And so even if you swear by your own head, you're swearing to the Lord. And what matters then is that your vow, whatever you make, is binding. There is no way out. And if that is the case, rather than trying to find loopholes, wouldn't it be so much better to just say yes or no? Jesus is deconstructing the way in which the Pharisees tried to set up a pretty much kind of a dishonest system where they could decide if they have to do what they said they would do. And it was pretty common amongst them, and obviously it would come down to the rest of the people. And the primary reason then, as Jesus ends, right, he's like, anything else comes from the evil one. The primary reason is if you're using this kind of language, the likelihood is that your heart really isn't in doing what you said you would do. In which case, you're being dishonest. We're being deceitful. And oftentimes when this was done, it was done to the detriment of the average people in Israel. And so Jesus is trying to break this apart. Now, if that's what Jesus is doing, now I want to go back to James. Because James is almost quoting Jesus word for word, right? He's cutting it down a little bit, but the point is almost exactly the same. And given the context of James, I think it's pretty important for us to understand that too. James was written to a group of believers that were probably experiencing some kind of suffering or some kind of persecution for their faith. Now, we know that James was written probably in the early to mid-40s, late 40s, sometime there. It's pretty early along in the church. And given that James is writing, it is probably written to the church in Jerusalem. And if you're writing to the church in Jerusalem, the primary antagonists that you would have to deal with, the primary people that are going to be dealing with you and in your faith, are going to be the Pharisees and the Jewish leaders, the very kinds of people that used to use their language in this way. And so as a reader of this letter, James is saying, listen, just like Jesus said about these people, I want to remind you that those who do this, condemnation is just. You've experienced it. Don't be like them. It's a really clear way of doing that, but it's a way of him connecting their experience with their reality. So now that we have a sense of the context, I actually want us to pause a second, kind of take an aside, and look really at an important question that exists around this. And it really is this question about vows and oaths, right? Because one way you could read this is to say, well, I should never take a vow. But probably the majority of us in this room are married, and I don't know about you, but if you've been married, the likelihood is you have taken a vow. You said for better or for worse, for richer or for poorer, those kinds of things, you know, till death do us part, like, I promise that I will fulfill this in your life. The law was full of places where one could take a vow. And we're going to look at a few of these in a moment, but one is encouraged oftentimes in the law to pursue vows to the Lord. And so either we see a shift in how the Bible deals with vows, or we want to understand better what it means when it talks about it. Perhaps you've had to put yourself in court and you've had to testify on the stand. What are you asked to do? You're asked to put your hand on the Bible or some other document that would be of similar import to you, and to swear that you're going to tell the truth. Oftentimes, again, we've been asked to make vows. If you're in the military or if you're someone who has served in an elected office, you're asked to take an oath to serve the Constitution. So the question is, should we not take any vows? Or is there a deeper thing going on that we have to embrace as we look at what James is saying? So let's look at a few passages that might help us understand this just a little bit better. The first one is in the Ten Commandments. It's in Exodus chapter 20, verse 7. It says, "You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name." Now, oftentimes we think of this as like saying, well, I shouldn't say, you know, like OMG, or, you know, we often say that, you know, I didn't realize that Jesus was one of the swear words out there. We often think of it, that's oftentimes what we mean in misusing God's name. But actually, it was more inclined as people thought about this law. It was more about what you swear you'll do. The real misuse of God's name is to say, I swear by God that I will accomplish this thing and then not do it. Because then we're saying something about God. We're saying that God mirrors our unfaithfulness. If God allows me to break this promise, then he also is one who might break promises. We see this also reiterated in Leviticus 19, verse 12. It says, don't swear falsely by my name, because when you do, you profane your God. I am the Lord. And so again, there's a sense of, it's not the don't do it, it's when you do it, what aren't you to do? You aren't to be false. In Numbers 30, there's actually a really significant discussion about vows. In fact, like half the chapter is about vows, and if you take vows, how you do them. Be a great study someday for yourself. We're going to look at verse 2. It says, when a man makes a vow to the Lord or takes an oath to obligate himself by a pledge, he must not break his word, but do everything that he said. It goes on then to talk about, like, well, there are certain ways you can break vows, and they're more about how someone shouldn't have made that vow. And there are certain ways that you must fulfill your vows. But overall, again, the Old Testament's like vows are a common part of how we walk out our faith, pledges. The last one that I want us really to look at in the Old Testament is in Numbers 6. There's a particular kind of vow that one can make in Numbers 6, and it's called a Nazirite vow. We don't really know a ton about these, but there are a few things that we know. And it included things like It could be done by a man or a woman. So in a culture that was pretty patriarchal, oftentimes women were not allowed to do things that men were. But in this particular case, a woman could make a Nazirite vow as well as a man. Oftentimes it was for a certain period of time. I'm going to take this vow for like 60 days. It was a form of consecration. Consecration is one of those terms that's like it's a purification, right? It's meant to take time to focus on purifying your life of things that might be like worldly. It's set aside to help make you more holy, to prepare you for something. It required certain ethical requirements, like while you were under your vow, you would hold to chastity. You wouldn't drink, things like that. And when it was complete, one would bring a sacrifice to the temple or the tabernacle, depending on what was there at the time, so that you would then fulfill your vow in that way. And so again, these are just common examples in the law of how vows function. These are very common in Israel. What's interesting is we see a number of bad examples in the Bible of vows. In the book of Judges, chapter 11, there's a judge by the name of Jephthah. Jephthah is there to help Israel against some of their enemies. He makes a vow. He says, if you give the Ammonites into my hands, then I will offer to you my whatever comes out first, out of my tent. Now, if you know the story, you know how it ends, but you can imagine how this could turn out really bad for Jephthah, depending on what comes out of his tent first, right? Well, this is what happens, that his daughter is the first thing to come out of his tent. And so he's like, oh man, I have to fulfill my vow. Now, we can debate whether he should have done that or not. That's not what we're here to do. But I would say this is a rash vow, and he probably shouldn't have made it. And if he did, he probably should have made it better, like the first animal or thing that came out of my tent. We see Saul, if we were to look at the story of Saul, one of the first kings of Israel, he makes a similarly rash vow, and he says in the middle of this battle, we're winning, he's like, no one's to eat or drink until this battle is won. And Jonathan, while he doesn't hear it, and while he's out and about running, he sees some honey, and he's like, ooh, I'm hungry, and I'm fighting, and it's good to get some calories in me. So he takes some honey and puts it in his mouth, and it says that he was all the more, vigorous in his fighting because of the food that he had eaten. And it later comes out that he didn't, or he ate. And now Saul has to say, do I fulfill my vow or do I not? He was going to, but the people said don't. And so Saul doesn't end up following through on this vow. But again, we see these rash vows that put people in really, really awkward places. So our vows at least should be thoughtful. At this point, though, you might respond like, sure, Tim, like I hear you. But all those are Old Testament passages, and like we're New Testament people. And so in the New Testament, like we probably, maybe Jesus is like, we shouldn't do this anymore. He's just changing kind of the rule set, if you will. Well, let's look at a couple New Testament examples that also we have to at least grapple with as we think about vows. First, we see that this is a number of years after James was written, that Paul, right before he goes back to Jerusalem, where he will end up going into prison at the end of Acts, he is under a vow, and he's going back to Jerusalem to pay his vow. It says in Acts 18:18, that he left the brothers. He stayed in Corinth for some time. He left the brothers and sisters and sailed for Syria. He was accompanied by some friends of his, Priscilla and Aquila. Before he sailed, he had his hair cut off at Kenchreae because of a vow that he had taken. Most folks assume that this is probably a Nazirite vow based on how it's described here. And in Acts 21, verses 21 to 24, this is as Paul comes back to Jerusalem. One of the problems that a lot of the Jews have with Paul is they think that Paul is like not Jewish anymore. He's like the law doesn't matter, and so they don't like him, and that's why they want to kill him. They think he's trying to overturn everything. And so when he comes back, the folks there, it's like, hey, it's been informed to us and others that you teach the Jews who live among the Gentiles to turn away from Moses, right? To turn away from the law, telling them not to circumcise their children or to live according to our customs. What are we going to do? They're certainly going to hear that you've come here because they hate you. So do what we tell you. There are four guys here who have made a vow. Take these four guys and join them in their purification rites and pay their expenses to show how on board you are with their vows, so that they can then have their head shaved. And then everyone's going to know that you are not doing this thing, right? That you, there's no truth to the reports that you are telling Jews to stop following Moses. So again, there's this idea that Paul is actively involved in this vow taking. He doesn't seem to have any problems with it. And I say all this not because I want to get into the weeds, although sometimes the weeds are fun, but because I think, as we think of vows, there are actually some real applications. Is it okay for us to make any vows or not? Again, this is the question that we laid before us. Or is the real issue how we make the vows? Is it our heart condition, or is it the very thing that we do? For instance, let us again consider wedding vows. It's one that most of us don't even probably think about as we do them. These are weighty promises that we make to one another, right? When I literally say, right, that I will be with you in sickness and in health, for richer, for poorer, for all of the things, we don't necessarily know when we're like, you know, 21 or 27 or 31 what we're signing up for. Because, you know, Darren always jokes, you know, he's on like Darren 7.0 now. We change about every 3 years. And so, you know, the common thing that people say oftentimes when they separate is like, you're not the person I married. It's like, no, you're not. And they won't be the same person that they are today 3 years from now. But the reality is that we don't know what those changes are. And so our promise is, I will be with you. That's our vow. Now, we don't say, upon the stars of heaven, I swear that I will always love you. And if you're writing vows and that's what you're writing, I encourage you to go with the traditional vows instead. But we have these simple things. And what's our response? It's not, I swear by whatever. It's, I do. It is a simple yes or no. Hopefully by the time you're standing here, it's a yes. And therefore, we should only break wedding vows in cases of extreme circumstances, which the Bible goes deeper in other times. Another example we could use even here would be our membership commitments. Perhaps you want to get around membership commitments by saying, well, I didn't make a vow there. That's fine, you could make that argument. But what would James and Jesus say? And say, let your yes be yes, and your no be no. To that end, as we think about commitments, as we ask the questions that we ask here, like when you're saying yes, you're just saying, yeah, I'm going to do the thing that I said. We read it to you and we give you those ahead of time. It's like, that's what I want to be about. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. Whether we call it a vow or whether we call it a commitment or whether we call it nothing else, if we bring you up here and ask you questions and you say yes, is that not actually a form of us saying, I promise to do this thing? We could offer lots of other examples, but in the end, I think that the true thrust of what James is getting at as we think about this is that our word is truly our bond. It's not by what we swear. It's where our heart is. And when we swear and do these other things, it's only in order to deal with dishonesty, whether we're known for dishonesty or whether we're trying to cut our own. So as we move toward the end of our meditation here on James 5, verse 12 this morning, I want to start with saying, what should our response to this passage be? It should be that we become more honest and faithful to our word. In fact, while I was talking through this text with my wife Kim this past week, she's like, all this stuff is fine and good. What does it really mean to me? Like, what am I supposed to do? And I think it means we need to be more clear and honest with our word and what we do and what we say and why we do it. You know, it's funny, this might be a frivolous example, but sometimes frivolity actually makes the point better than serious things. In our new communication age, there is a tendency now, because we're aware of everything going on, that we're often looking at all of our options and like waiting for the best thing to pop up. It's like, I want to do something this weekend, and like I see there's this thing I could do, and 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 it's like, boy, all of those are great. One of those is better than the others, and if all of these good things are going on, maybe there's something else. And so sometimes we say yes to the first thing that happens, but then something better comes along, and it's like, oh, stink, how do I get out of this one thing that I said I would do? so that I could go to this better thing that I said I would do, because we have, in the social media age, this fear of missing out, because we see pictures of our friends at that really cool thing over there, and we're like, oh, crap, I missed out. I wish I would have gone to that instead of this. And that actually impacts how we address these other things. And so we're waiting and we're hoping, and sometimes we're like, I won't give an answer because I don't want to bind myself to a yes or a no. I suppose that's all right. We're giving a maybe. But we all know that if someone says maybe, what's the answer? No, right? 9 times out of 10, if I say maybe, my kids have learned. I mean no. I just don't want to say it yet. No, I'm... And so as we think about this, this is actually a really important thing. In fact, this past week, I had another friend who was planning to visit in September, but was given an invitation to do something that was actually important, like it was job-related. And so they emailed me back, and they're like, hey, we're still on for this, right? Like, we're doing this on these dates because I have this other invitation, but you get first dibs. And so I was like, yeah, we're still planning to do this. And they're like, okay, I will tell these other people now. But it was really great because it was one of those times where it's like they could have said, like, this is job related, this is super important, and I can't come. But in this situation, they let their yes be yes and their no be no. And so one of the things that I want us to take away is that ultimately our words matter. What we say to whom we say them matter. And perhaps we need to be more judicious in saying what we'll do. Maybe we say yes too often. I mean, it's kind of like people-pleaser syndrome where, you know, anytime someone asks me to do something, like, yeah, I'll do that. And all of a sudden my schedule's full and I'm like, oh, crap, I can't do all those things. I can't do that one, but I can do this one. Maybe we need to learn in that case to be less rash with saying, yeah, I'll do that, because our words matter. And so regardless of whether or not we're doing that or we're always who say no because to say yes actually forces me to do something that I might not want to do, don't be a people of rash vows and oaths, because that ultimately shows a heart that leads to condemnation. Rather be a people whose yes is yes and our no is no. And so as we prepare, it's beautiful to have the table before us this morning. Because one of the downsides of this passage actually is there isn't a lot of gospel in it, right? Like, it's just do this thing. There's not a lot of, like, Jesus is here with you in it. It's just do it. And so the question I always have with commands is why? Like, I can tell you what to do, but why should we do it? I mean, I could walk away and say, yeah, we do it because God said so. And that's a good enough answer. But I think God gives us better answers even than just that. The deeper answer is that God is far more faithful to his word than we will ever be to our word. And if God can be faithful to his word, we should be faithful to ours. In fact, the scriptures are full of God's promises to his people. And in 2 Corinthians 1:20, it even says, however many promises that God has made, right? Here you go, it's on the screen now. For no matter how many promises God has made, they are all yes in Christ. And so through him, right, the amen, which by the way, amen is another way of saying yes. That's why, you know, in some preaching situations, people are like, amen. It's like, I agree with you, right? Yes is spoken by us to the glory of God. In Christ, all of God's promises are yes. And so it is in Christ that we actually see the probably the most amazing place where someone had to say yes to fulfill a promise, but probably wished they didn't have to. In the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus is praying, and in one of the accounts it talks about, he's praying with so much fervor that he's dripping blood like sweat. Right? There's so much going on in his heart, anxiety and all of the things, and he is so distraught that he's sweating droplets of blood. And why? Because he knows that the next day is going to bring beatings that will take him near to death, that they're going to nail him up to a cross and hang him until he dies, and that in this process, he is going to experience the Father forsaking him for the first time ever. that Christ, who has lived in perfect community with the Father and the Spirit for all of eternity, is going to experience a moment where the Father turns his back on the Son. And as he thinks about this, in his prayer, he says, you know, he alludes to a question, right? He's like, is there another way? Is there another way we could do this? Again, he already knows that there's no other way, because the Father and the Spirit and Jesus had already said, we know we're going to create, and we know that we're going to save humanity, and we know how we're going to do it. But Jesus, who's 100% human and knows what's coming, he's like, just one last check. Maybe we missed it. Is there another way to do this? Because if there is, I would love to go that route. But he knows that there's not. And so in the end, he submits himself to the Father's will and he goes to the cross. His faithfulness to the promises that he has made lead him to take all of humanity's sin in himself, and it leads him to the cross where he dies. That's why we're called to be faithful to our word. Because the love of God meant that Christ would suffer and die. And that's why our yes is yes, and our no is no.